Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Listen, I know people think I'm woke, but I'm having a full fat ermine.
Yeah.
Welcome to The Power Test. I'm Aisha Hazarika.
And I'm Sam Friedman. Well, it's good to be back. A lot's changed in the few months since we've been away. One of which is that you, in a remarkable bit of one-upmanship, have become a baroness. Well, I have failed to become a parliamentarian of any kind. Tell us how it happened. Did you know it was coming?
It's all been a bit of a shock, really. I mean, obviously, they did call me to say, would you be
would
okay
you like to be a baroness?
With your name going forward? And I was like, yeah. Actually, when I got the phone call, I thought I'd done something really bad and I was going to get expelled from the party. I was like, oh, God, I've tweeted. So I got a call from Sue Gray and I was like, oh, my God, what have I done? I'm going to get suspended. I'm really sorry, Sue. And then, you know, it goes off to some commission and then I didn't hear anything again. And I was thinking, is this happening? Is it not happening? And I was told that I would get a good 2-3 days of notice because I hadn't told a soul. Mm. You know, I hadn't told my parents, hadn't told my employers, crucially. And then I was actually interviewing Satnam Sangera about his brilliant new book called Empire World. And we were talking about how terrible the British establishment is.
And then you get pings through.
Literally, my phone started going mad. I was like, it looks like I'm joining the aforementioned horrendous like British establishment. It's been a very lovely, lovely thing. Very chuffed, quite overwhelmed though. I did my induction day yesterday at the Lords and it's a bit like being a sort of geriatric fresher.
Presumably in this crowd, you're the youngest or one of the youngest.
Do you know, I've been really wrestling with my advancing years and suddenly I feel but a slip
fresh
of a
face.
Girl again. It's fabulous. But in the same list that I was put on, Plaid Cymru put, I'm sure she's very, 27, I think.
Yes, I saw that. The youngest one ever or something. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously Boris Johnson put in a few quite young people.
Yes.
Charlotte.
So there's a little bit of youth amongst the...
There is a little bit, but I think I'm pretty young in the Labour group. But yeah, there's just a lot to take in and I, you know, it's a big responsibility and I want to do it well and I'm having a lot of anxiety. I keep waking up in the middle of the night going, oh, what if I suddenly flog loads of dodgy PPE by accident and forget to... I'm like, oh my God. Then I'm like, I don't have access to that sort of facility.
No,
should
be
fine.
Right. And have you got a name? Do you have a baroness of somewhere?
I do.
Tell us your name.
Drum roll. I'm going to be Baroness Hazarika of Coatbridge in the county of North Lanarkshire.
Right, that sounds very grand. It sounds like you're about to raise an army to march on London. Excellent. Do you hire a mink?
When I went, I had lots of meetings yesterday and I went into a room and a lady sort of grabbed me and said, we need to sort of measure you and your height. And then it's very funny. They were like, we need to get you kitted out for a robe. And they were like, are you having normal ermine or vegetarian ermine? And I was like... Listen, I know people think I'm woke, but I'm having a full fat ermine.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate for the Lords.
I think so.
Be too woke.
I think so. But no, it's going to be very exciting. But I am feeling quite sort of daunted about it as well. And as you imagine, Twitter's been just joyful.
Yes, everyone's lots of congratulations.
Just
and also
such warmth.
Yes, lots of people less warm about the prospect. The challenge for all of us is that the Lords is a bit of a strange place and probably does need reform. But at the same time, you want good people to be in it. So.
Mm. And also, I would say this, wouldn't I? Now that I'm going in.
Yes. Like, no, it's actually, don't it's touch actually, it. It's fine.
It's all marvellous. No, it definitely needs reform. And actually, what was really interesting is, you know, many of the meetings I've had so far, even with people who are absolute stalwarts, are saying they understand that the reputation is pretty poor, yeah, you know, outside. So they were like, we've got to up our game. But then I would also argue that away from obviously the important negative stories, the Michelle Moons and others and things like that, you look at something like the Rwanda bill and actually you think, when our commons is so wild at the moment... Yeah. I'm actually, and I'm sure many people are actually quite grateful to have a proper legislative check and balance and actual scrutiny. Because also you're in this paradoxical situation in the Commons where probably the kind of quality of people in the Commons is really poor at the moment. Mm. The level of the debate is very poor. Also, they're not doing a lot and the little that is going through is not getting a lot of scrutiny. Like, they are rushing stuff through.
Well, the big difference between the two is that in the Commons, the government controls the timetable, right? So it says, we're only going to have 4 hours of debate about Rwanda. You only get 4 hours of debate, even if there's lots of concern or worry. Whereas in the Lords, it can go as long as people want it to go. Therefore, you will have a long and proper debate about it.
You often do feel as though, because the Lords is... It's less tribal than the Commons. You get very interesting, thoughtful interventions from, let's say, some Conservatives have made really interesting interventions on Rwanda, not to make a party political point, but just on the rule of law and the sort of honesty about the situation. So, I mean, of course, I would say this anyway, but I think it definitely needs to be improved. But I think we should also recognise that particularly now it is doing some quite useful work.
And it's unlikely to be an immediate priority for a Labour government, given all of the other things that we will come on to as being challenges that they have to deal with when they win. And I say when. I think when we first started this programme, both of us felt that the election was still open and pretty much any result was still possible. I think by last series, I was pretty convinced that Labour were going to win. I think by this point, even you are going to have to accept it's... close to inevitable that they are going to win.
I will concede that it's looking very likely that there will be a Labour government. But what I am not buying into yet, and I don't think I ever, until the actual, you know, final numbers are counted, this kind of giant landslide. My arguments of that are, A, we're a long way. I mean, we've just had it announced that we're probably not going to have a May election. So if I'm Rishi Sunak's team, I'm going to go as long as possible now. Yeah. The longer they leave it, they can argue that we will still see some upticks in the economy. Mm. The plan is working, they can say. But I think what's really going to be difficult for Labour is going to be in this quite torturous holding pattern now where the public know that Labour's probably going to be the next government. Mm. They're beginning to treat the Labour Party like they're the next government and they want to know what are they going to do and where they're going to get the money from, and Labour people cannot answer that question.
Yeah, and we'll sort of come on to that challenge, I guess, a bit more. Where I disagree a bit is... Yeah, I wouldn't say a giant majority is guaranteed by any stretch. I think lots of results are still possible. But it's just very hard to see where the Tory support's going to come from. Everything is going wrong at the same time. The anger towards them, even in focus groups made up of people who voted Tory in 2019, is so strong. I mean, you talk to Tory MPs, they're saying it's the worst doorsteps they've ever had in private. They won't say that in public. And you look at the government satisfaction levels are kind of like -73 in Ipsos and so on. They have such a long way to travel to get back to a position where they could win even 200 seats. Say the economy is one route, but yes, you know, inflation is coming down, will keep going down. We probably won't be in a technical recession, but no one's going to feel richer than they were 4 or 5 years ago, because they're not going to be richer than they were 4 or 5 years ago.
No, I mean, I accept that. But I think what you are missing is that I think once the short campaign gets going in earnest, I think you can't underestimate the Conservatives. The Conservatives always gain more ground in a short campaign.
2017.
Well, 2015.
They have done sometimes, but, you know, in 2015, and I know this is a bit of a sore spot for you, but they had a really clear political strategy. They had done austerity. The economy was growing again in 2014, 2015, and they were able to say, you know, our plan has worked. It turned out it hadn't worked, but they were able to say at that point, our plan has worked. And it was believable.
But
you can't say that now.
That's not the point. What you're not factoring in is, I think, how hostile this campaign is going to be. I think a lot of the right-wing press are going to absolutely swing into action in a way that they haven't even begun to do. I think that the TV debates could be really, really difficult. And sometimes something can happen in a short campaign. There can be a moment which just sort of electrifies the campaign for good reasons and for really, really bad reasons. There's no doubt that I think that they're going to lose. But the question that Tory MPs are saying to me is, by how much are we going to lose? And I think there is a feeling that because, yeah, they know that the public absolutely hates them, dislikes them a bit, we all know intensely hates them, there isn't a massive surge of love for the Labour Party, right? And they're seeing the same focus group polling that the Labour Party is as well. And that's why Labour strategists have still got that kind of note of caution. Yeah. I also think that some very bad campaigning is going to come into play, which I think, you know, could get a bit of traction. Now, I don't think this is going to stop Labour from forming a government, but we also know that if Labour does win, their inheritance is going to be so, so difficult.
And that's why it makes a big difference. This, you know, if we move the question from are they going to win to by how much are they going to win, that makes a huge difference because they've got a majority of 20. That's very different from a majority of 120, which might probably be the sweet spot because a majority of 260, which some of the polls would put them at, is actually makes party management almost impossible.
They know that what they're going to inherit is going to be incredibly difficult economically, socially, the NHS, geopolitically as well. And I think foreign policy is going to be really tough for Labour, any Labour government struggles. What many Labour people are really thinking about is a win's a win. Labour's only had six prime ministers in the last 100 years.
And if they
replaced
Sunak, the Tories would have had six prime ministers since Brexit.
Exactly, exactly. And so they're conscious about just getting over the line. They're conscious about how brilliant Labour is at losing elections. But I think people are also kind of thinking, you don't want to just scrape a win. You want to win with a feeling of goodwill from the public. You want to have some credit in the bank for when things are going to get very, very difficult.
Yeah, and you want to be able to win votes. There are still 30-odd MPs who are a socialist campaign group who are not going to be willing to vote with Starmer on every vote.
And we also know that other parts of the progressive movement, the trade unions, for example, and others, are very much saying now, look, the only thing, I was speaking to some trade union people just last night, and they were saying that the only thing that matters is getting Starmer over the line and getting the Tories out. However, we're going to be coming on day one and we are going to be pushing Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer hard as well. So they're going to have a lot to contend with from day one.
For me, the kind of moment where you're going to get that factionism, I guess, coalescing is around the first spending review, which they will have to do. They have to do something by March 2025 because no department has a budget from April 2025 onwards and the Tories won't set one before they're out. So they will suddenly be confronted with every department saying we need 10, 20 billion more pounds and having good cases in each case for that 10 to 20 billion more pounds. And they can't possibly do that even if they're willing to put up taxes by a fair bit. They're going to have to do some brutal prioritisation straight off the bat. That means people are going to be upset. Labour MPs have been campaigning on a particular health issue or a welfare issue their whole career, are suddenly going to find they don't get what they wanted. And that's when you get the initial flashpoints.
Absolutely. And, you know, for all the Labour MPs that are really, really excited about becoming ministers, and that is going to be a great moment for many of them, again, I keep thinking about the fact that there is just not going to be any scope to have a honeymoon period. In fact, you may be in the position where even just a month or two into a Labour government, you have ministers on the morning round looking as beleaguered as the Tory ministers are now.
Well, there's a scenario where if the Tories don't ask the OBR for another forecast before the election, then Labour would have to pretty much straight away because there is a legal requirement to have two every year. If the economy, global economy has got worse and that forecast comes back and says you've got a £20 billion hole now, sorry, that immediately they're in a position where even to keep things at the same level, they have to put up taxes or cut spending. So that could be, again, could be something that they have to confront almost straight away. So a lot of pressure is actually on Rachel Reeves as much as Keir Starmer. She's building up her profile quite successfully, but also you can tell, I guess, that she's really starting to feel that pressure of expectation coming from the party whilst also trying to stick to her line on being prudent and sensible.
Since we last gathered, of course, there was a big development on Labour's big green economy plan. The £28 billion was ditched. I mean, that was sort of the one big dividing line on the economy. It gave candidates something to talk about. Many candidates said the £28 billion's great because when people say to me, well, what's the difference between you and the Tories? We go, look at our green Green Prosperity Plan, $28 billion. Now, Rachel Reeves and Wes Streeting, I actually thought did quite a good job in terms of explaining that after the event. But it has left a kind of a sense of anxiety around the economy. Now, Rachel Reeves did a big speech last night. It wasn't anything sort of new, but it was really consolidating all of her current thinking. What did you think of that?
I thought it was quite a good illustration of, in a way, that the bind that Labour in at the moment. You know, she made a lot of compelling arguments, some of which she'd made before, about why we're in the position we're in. And not just criticising the Tories, also being quite critical of New Labour and some of the mistakes that New Labour had made around financial regulation and so on. So I thought her diagnosis was very clear. And then she gets to now and she gets stuck because she talks about a lack of public investment, which is true. There has been a very severe lack of public investment over quite a long time in the UK. And she talks about getting the OBR to publish figures on public investment. But then she can't then say, I'm going to make some public investment, because that would mean breaking her own fiscal rule, which she reaffirmed in the speech. You sort of feel this frustration coming through that she can go so far but no further. And what I still just cannot tell is whether she believes that she can't go further or whether she feels she has to say that because of where the electoral cycle is right now, and whether if she really was going with her conviction, she'd say, and therefore we're going to spend, you know, $50 billion on infrastructure to get Britain moving again, or whether actually she really believes she has to stick within the fiscal rule because of the state of the economy.
I think she believes it.
Yeah.
I have asked her this. I've asked her this. I don't think she's just saying it for the sake of it, to insulate her from a Conservative attack line. Yeah. I genuinely think she believes it. I mean, I've known Rachel for a long time. I've worked with Rachel for a long time. She was in the, you know, Ed Miliband's shadow cabinet. She is fiscally very hawkish. She believes all of this stuff. Many people are expecting slash hoping that when she gets into number 11, she'll suddenly go, da-da, like pull off a mask and be like, guess what, guys? I'm actually going to change my fiscal rules and everything. I don't think she's going to do that. I think when she says she wants to be kind of an Iron Chancellor, she sort of means it. I mean, one of the other things that I wanted to sort of ask you is that when you hear Rachel or Darren Jones or anyone else, their go-to answer, and it's not dissimilar from Jeremy Hunt, to be honest, is growth, which we're going to magic this growth up. But we all know that you don't rock up at Downing Street. There's a big lever.
No, in the basement.
Growth. How plausible is their trust us, we're just going to get growth argument?
Both, you know, Jeremy Hunt and Rachel, when they say it, they're right, of course, that the only long-term way out of the position we're in as a country is economic growth, because you know, you can't just keep putting taxes up over and over again. Eventually, the public services will just run out of money if we don't get growth. The quality of life for people will go down. So they're right. And there are things you could do to generate growth. You know, Rachel Reeves talks a lot about planning reform. That would certainly make a difference. But it's not going to suddenly generate 2-3 points of GDP a year. You know, this stuff takes a long time, is complicated. It will help, but it's not magic. You know, you look at the OBR forecast, they're based on us growing at, you know, 1.5-2% anyway over the next year, which is much more than we've done over the last few years. So they're anticipating some improvement in growth anyway in the terrible figures that they're going to have to deal with. Can they really get growth to 3-3.5%, which is the kind of, you know, the first two Blair terms level? There's not a lot of evidence that they can, even if they do the sort of things that they're talking about and are able to push them through. And even if you do, it's not going to come in the first 2-3 years.
It will take time.
You can't just wait.
It will take time.
You can't just wait all of that time for it to happen. There is so much pressure on so many different parts of the public sector. Councils will literally go bankrupt. It really is at that stage. I think 150 out of 200 NHS trusts are in deficit this year, and we'll also, you know, need bailing out. We are at a point where it's not feasible to go 2-3 years on this kind of spending level. So there is going to be a crunch point, and I don't know who's going to sort of blink first, but something is going to have to change in that first couple of years from what they're saying is going to happen, however much she believes.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder, just listening to you, if it will take a crisis of some kind to justify
something. The way I would do it if I were them would be to go in and say, okay, we've had a look around government. Jesus, they've left it an even bigger mess than you thought. We need a healthcare levy, an emergency healthcare levy, otherwise the NHS is going to completely collapse. We need to change council tax, otherwise all your councils are going to collapse. You use the fact that the Tories have screwed everything up to do the radical, unpopular thing, and then you hope in 5 years' time people have forgiven you for doing that and are happy with the better public services that you get as a result. The alternative is you don't do anything, And then you just get blamed for things getting even worse in 5 years.
Yeah, it's really, really hard because I've heard a lot of people make the argument you've just made about you come in, you not just make it up, you do see that things are terrible. You have to put taxes up. I suppose the really difficult thing, particularly for Rachel Reeves, is she doesn't want to be seen as a sort of flip-flopper. I think she's a bit stung by that £28 billion figure. She's been really, really clear that she doesn't want to put taxes up on working people. I just think she will be really loath to come in and say no new taxes, read my lips, no new taxes. And then one of the first things she does is break that promise and have to put taxes up. I think that for her will feel like a very difficult line to cross, even though you're hoping that this money will magically solve everything by the time the next election comes around. But that's a great attack line from the get-go for the Tories and others.
Depends if people believe it was necessary. It's just whether you can convince people it was necessary. Osborne was able to convince people that austerity was necessary in 2010. People didn't want the pension age to go up. You know, they didn't want cuts to public services, but they believed that we were going to turn into Greece if that didn't happen.
But like, I think that's different. Cutting services, which have proved to be disastrous, and this is no way defending this. That feels like that is an easier sell as to, right, I'm taking more money out of your direct pocket to spend in your... That's a tougher sell.
I don't disagree. It's a hard sell, but I think you have to pin it on the Conservatives. They've got a window where they can pin it on the Conservatives that it's necessary. Conservatives have done two tax cuts. They haven't got any credit for doing two tax cuts from the voters. And when you focus group it, people say, it's a bribe. Don't believe it. They're going to take it all back again. They kind of know it's not real. So there's an element to which people are willing to accept that they're being kind of lied to at the moment and therefore being told the truth after the election.
But not being grateful for having money sort of not taken away from you is different.
No, I'm not saying people, don't get me wrong, no one's going to be going,
like, yay,
yes,
tax rises.
This is exactly what we wanted. It would be unpopular, you know. I just think you do the unpopular thing first with the strongest justification that you can possibly do it, and then you've got 5 years to show that it was necessary to do it.
I mean, I have heard the argument you've promulgated many, many times. Now, look, the other thing since we've last sort of gathered, and particularly because we've got local elections on the horizon, let's just have a quick chat about reform, because I think reform have become really interesting over the last sort of month or two. I encounter Richard Tice quite often in various TV studios.
Sorry for you.
But what's fascinating is that they do have a kind of real confidence about them, and they know that they're not going to win any seats. They might hold on to Lee Anderson's seat just.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of seats that if they stood a really good, like Clacton, they could conceivably win if they stood a really good candidate. But it's not going to be more than one or two.
But if they get one or two, I mean, that's still kind of something. Yeah. But what I think is going to be really interesting, and this gets to your point about what the Conservatives are going to be like in opposition, I think the master plan from Reform is to contribute to completely smashing up the Conservative Party and then sort of taking over the Conservative Party in opposition.
I agree that the plan looks like a reverse takeover. Now, you look at Tice and you look at Farage, and actually their positions, although more robustly expressed often, are not very different to your average Tory activist. You know, they're obviously anti-EU, they're anti-immigration.
Net zero.
Don't like net zero. Low taxes, low spending. You know, they're pretty conventionally aligned with Tory activists. So, no, I think you're right. The plan is Tories in decline, finish them off, take over the rotting hulk and build it back up again with a Farage as leader. I think there's probably just enough people left in the Tory party who don't want that to happen for it to not happen, even if they do very, very badly in the election. But it's not impossible because the sort of remaining Liberal Tories, such as they are just sort of so fed up and so miserable and almost sort of on the verge of giving up. And if they do that, then it's conceivable.
I mean, I spoke to a Conservative MP who said, to be honest, if Nigel Farage rocked up and wanted to stand in my seat, I'd love that. I think he's amazing. I'd happily stand aside and let him have my seat. So I do think there's going to be a very interesting realignment.
Yeah, and there'll be a strong push from GB News, from the Mail, Unite the Right, let Farage take over the
Tories. Paul Marshall might even own the Telegraph.
Yeah, right, and then so they'll join in as well. So you can see how it could happen.
Now let's just swing back to Labour. You know, we've had a bit of time since we last gathered. Labour's still riding very high in the polls. We've also seen a big effort to try and get more information out about Keir Starmer, the man, Tom Baldwin's book. There's been a big effort to sort of humanise Keir Starmer. But what would you say are the policy areas which have cut through with people? Or what do you think the kind of Labour offer is that's on the table that hasn't been watered down yet or may not be, that is the thing that people are still going, yep, that could actually really make a difference.
See, for your normal voters, I don't think there is one. I think, you know, again, you look at focus groups, you look at polling, people do not know what Labour stands for. They think they can't be worse than the other lot, which is not a resounding endorsement. I think for me, by far and away, their most exciting is policy is on housing and planning. You know, if they do what they say they're going to do, and Rachel Reeves again sort of emphasised it in her speech as being something she was absolutely committed to. If they do that, that will break a logjam in British politics that's been there for, you know, decades and decades and decades. That would be a huge achievement, and it would contribute to growth and help people afford houses, which is critical. The workers' rights stuff is interesting. I get the feeling there are people in the party who want to water that down. I'd be interested in your take on that. Do you think that is something they will actually stick with in government?
I think it's one of the areas which is honing into view as an area for a bit of a fight. Mm. Because Labour has done incredibly well with the business community. You know, the business days that Labour have held have been so popular. One public affairs manager said it's actually easier to get a ticket for Taylor Swift than it is to get a ticket for the Labour business days. They are absolutely rammed.
And
these
got
events.
Tickets for Taylor Swift, and it was not easy. So I can tell you, that's impressive.
I think Labour's done such a huge work in terms of building bridges with business, and business is sort of flocking to Labour. But this is definitely something that does come up. You know, I've been at many a business event where people have asked this question. And this is going to be such an interesting sort of symbolic issue where you're really going to see, I think, Angela Rayner kind of clashing with Rachel Reeves. This is Angela Rayner's thing. Mm. She really, really believes all of this stuff. And there is, you know, a sizable chunk of the movement, which is like, you have got to give us something, right? You've got to give us something. Labour is very much still with it, but there has been quite a lot of briefing. There's been quite a lot of leaking to the paper saying that there's internal wranglings. I thought that Rachel Reeves' language was interesting because she did stick to it. And she said, you know, we're going to enforce these rights from day one. She did say, however, fair dismissal would still be allowed. And I feel like that was a sort of signal to the...
She's trying to calm the business
to employers, saying, look, this is not, you know, you're never going to be able to sort of sack anyone. But I think if Labour waters this down, you are going to get into a real reputational issue.
I don't
think
they can. I think there's the few things that they've got left. There's like this... VAT on private schools, the sort of small number of things that they're sort of offering the left, I guess. They can't really let those things go now.
Also, I think in terms of where the mood music is, we've just had this week, this, you know, the P&O story was really shocking when it happened, you know, those years ago, and everyone's like, something must be done, you know, we've got to do something to protect workers' rights. And, you know, years on, it's like, oh, actually not that much has been done. So I do feel that there is a kind of mood from progressives, which is if you touch this, you are going to have a really, really big problem.
Yeah, I guess it's more when they're in government, when Reeves is doing that first budget, and she wants the CBI to come out and say something nice about it and business leaders to line up behind it. And they're saying, well, maybe soften that down a bit and we'll come out and back you. That will be the moment of decision.
And look, that's always a struggle. And the other thing, and I remember this from when I was a special advisor in government, particularly dealing with equality issues, I helped draft the Equality Act. My goodness, the pushback we got. Funnily enough, not only from the business community, but from people within the Labour Party who felt they were advocating for business. They were absolutely hardline about, you know, doing anything to increase workers' rights or union representation or things like representative actions or class actions or anything like that. Anything that made it easier to enforce workers' rights. There was a lot of internal pushback.
I mean, you know, go back to 97 and there was a big push against the minimum wage being introduced. There was a lot of hostility to that. I mean, they went ahead and did it anyway. Now, I think very few people would argue we should get rid of it. So they held out and that was a success. Tell us a bit more, take us a bit behind the scenes, I guess, on what are they focusing on? How are they doing it? And how do you think they're doing it successfully? Do you think that's working?
Every advisor at this point in an electoral cycle, the comms team suddenly start panicking about wanting to do the backstory. Mm. And we, of course, have had a lot of backstory from Keir Starmer. I don't know if you know that his dad was like a tool.
I've heard that maybe he was. Yeah.
And I actually feel really sorry for leaders at this point.
Rishi Sunak talks about Winchester. No, he doesn't talk about Winchester.
That was a pharmacist. Yeah. I actually feel quite sorry for politicians at this point because most of them are like pathologically ruthless to have got to the position.
But they have to pretend to be cuddly.
Yeah. They've probably done unspeakable things to loved ones and colleagues. They've basically had no soul to get to where they are. And suddenly they have to be like, oh my God. Look, Keir Starmer is not, you know, he's an older gentleman. He's had a lot of, he's like 60 now, or he's nearly 60.
Doesn't look 60.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good for his age. Yeah. But do you want to be talking about your mum and dad at the age of this? And I think there's so much pressure on politicians happened, that suddenly, and it only happens a year before an election, it's like, suddenly give us your backstory.
Yeah.
When you were five, what was your favourite teddy? Tell us that time you wet yourself and you're still traumatised. I feel quite sorry for them because I feel like they are forced to do public therapy about their family.
And he does look quite uncomfortable talking about it, you know.
I mean, I think it's interesting. And I think, you know, the Tom Baldwin book has gone down well with people who want to know more about Keir Starmer. I mean, Keir Starmer was originally going to write the book himself.
Yeah, well, I think it was definitely better the way they did it.
And then Tom Baldwin sort of did it. Genuinely, I don't know if this stuff really moves the needle. People are not going to change their mind about voting for Keir Starmer because they heard about, you know, what happened to him when he was 11 years old or something. I think in really cynical terms, and I hate this as a feminist, I absolutely hate it, but I think it is true. I think the only thing that people are really interested in is they love a snapshot into the family.
Mm.
They love to get to know a bit about the wife or the husband.
Mm.
They like a little peek behind domestic life. I'm kind of cringing as I say it, but I think Keir Starmer's wife, Victoria, is a huge asset to him. Mm. She's a brilliant woman.
She's very private, though. They've kept everything very private.
They have kept everything, but they look good together. Mm. And, you know, it underlines the fact that he's a pretty noble... He's kind of like dad-in-chief.
Mm.
You know, he loves his kids. He's a very family man. He loves his wife. He's not going to go off and like have it off with the intern. He's not that kind of guy.
What it does is it makes attempts to scare people about him look ridiculous. He's not a person that looks scary. And I think that sort of means that whilst there still isn't vast enthusiasm, there's attempts by the Telegraph and Mail to whip up kind of commie Keir is not going to work.
Exactly. Particularly when they're trying to do stuff like, you know, he took the knee or he represented jihadis and or Jimmy Savile and all that kind of stuff. I think this is an attempt to be like, he's actually a really decent guy. He's really normal. He's just like a family guy. And he loves this country.
Yes. Big flag behind him all
wrapped
the time.
In a flag. Well, Sam, it is so great to be back with you. And my goodness, what an exciting year it's going to be as we pitch roll towards this general election. We are going to have plenty more to talk about. And we are going to be broadcasting every week now.
Up until the election.
Up until the election. And we'd love you to get in contact with us as well. What are your thoughts about what you've just heard from Sam and myself? What are the big things that are really troubling you or, you know, picking your brains about what lies ahead for a Labour government? Do let us know. You can tweet us at the Power Test, or because we like a bit of bureaucracy on this podcast, there's a form that you can fill out on the website, which is powertest.co.uk.
It wouldn't be socialism without some bureaucracy.
Some red tape.
Exactly.
We can slash it at a future date.
Exactly.
As part of an efficiency drive. A bonfire.
bonfire of our form.
Thank you for all your support for the Power Test, but we couldn't be made without our brilliant partner organisations, including the Future Governance Forum, to the Centre for Progressive Policy and to the Tony Blair Institute. We're very grateful for your support.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.